'Twas General Booth, I think, who commented that in attempting any great work for God, it's first of all impossible, it's then difficult, finally it's done. The point being, of course, that from first to last, there's no stage you could call easy. And that was certainly in accord with Nehemiah's experience. His ambition, you remember, was to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. Humanly speaking, it was an impractical dream. For a start, he was 1,000 miles away, in Babylonia. And even if he had the resources for such a journey, the nature of his employment forbade it. For he was a personal servant of the emperor there, a job which offered neither holidays nor a company car. The very idea of him going to Jerusalem to manage the reconstruction of the city was, to all human eyes, impossible. And yet, as we saw in our last study, after 3 months of waiting and prayer, it all began to happen for him. The king, in an extraordinary, one's tempted to say miraculous, a fit of magnanimity, not only gave him the necessary leave of absence, he also agreed to provide him with all the necessary material resources to commence this great rebuilding enterprise. Suddenly, the idea was no longer an impractical dream. It could be done. But, of course, that is not to say it would be easy. From the initial stage of impossibility, which required Nehemiah to be a man of prayer, we move today to look at the second stage, the stage of difficulty, which requires him to be a man of courage. I want us to look at 3 areas of difficulty that Nehemiah encountered together. First of all, I want us to look at the second half of chapter 2 and consider the difficulty of getting the ball rolling. Because as any of you who've ever tried to get something to happen in a church, that isn't always easy. Then I want us to look at chapter 4, the chapter we've just read, to look at the discouragement that Nehemiah faced. For those can be pretty difficult to handle too. And then finally, I want us to look at chapter 6, to look at the kind of personal attacks on his leadership that he had to cope with. Perhaps the most severe challenge to him of all. First of all then, let's scan the last part of chapter 2 under the theme of getting the ball rolling. You'll see from verse 10 that opposition was on the horizon right from the beginning. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about this, that is, that he'd arrived, they were much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. I read somewhere in a book on management that there are 2 fallacies about success. One is that it can be achieved simply by dint of good organization. And the second is that it can be achieved without it. Well, of course, it's a wise word, isn't it? The truth is you need organization if you're going to get the ball rolling of any enterprise, but you do need more than that. Because, of course, a manager is not just dealing with pieces of paper or machines, he's dealing with people. People don't let you forget how intractable they sometimes are. You need personnel skills, then. Management skills much more broadly than simply the ability to organize. And I think you'll find, if you look through this last half of Nehemiah chapter 2, that Nehemiah is a splendid example of precisely that kind of skill, which enables a leader to get the ball rolling. Notice the first thing he does when he arrives at Jerusalem. Reconnaissance. Verse 11 of chapter 2. I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there 3 days, I set out during the night with a few men. I hadn't told anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. There were no mounts with me except the one I was riding on. By night I went out through the valley gate towards the jackal well and the dung gate, examining the walls of Jerusalem which had been broken down, and its gates, which had been destroyed by fire. See, one of the classic ways in which immature leaders demonstrate their inexperience is impetuosity. In their thoughtless zeal, they rush in like the proverbial bull in the china shop, and make all kind of blunders as a result. and not Nehemiah. When he stood before those leading Jews a few days later to share with them his great vision of rebuilding the city, knowing that there would be tension and doubt and opposition amongst them, he wanted to be sure he knew what he was talking about. So he secretly investigates the situation. He assesses the damage. He calculates the amount of repairs to be done. He makes a mental note of the likely problems that are going to arise. It's a very important principle, vital for any kind of Christian endeavor. The first step to get the ball rolling is not to start working, not even to call a committee meeting. The first step is to find out all you can about the task. You have a vision to evangelize the Muslims. Well, you don't start by buying a ticket to Arabia, nor even by applying to the Missionary Society. You start by learning everything you can about Muslim culture. You reconnaissance the task. You want to plant a church in the inner city? Well, you don't start by getting a flat in Bermondsey. You don't even apply to the London City Mission. You start by finding out everything you can about urban problems today. Research. Planning. That's where you start. To an activist, of course, it often feels like a waste of effort. But you see, misdirected energy is wasted energy. And if we want our work to count, then we have to make sure that it's channeled in the right way. So that when we appear before people and say, God is calling me to do something, we don't make a fool of ourselves. God doesn't just demand that we do things for him. He demands that we think about what we're going to do. Reconnoiter the walls, then. That was the first step. Thoughtful planning. Then there's something else about Nehemiah in getting the ball rolling, which is important here. His skill at motivating the people. Look at verse 17. I said to them, that's the Jews, the priests, the nobles, and the officials, you see the trouble we're in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace. Now, it's clear the majority of Jews in Jerusalem at this time were pretty demoralized. They felt they were in disgrace, as he says. For a start, it was humiliating that their beloved city should be in such a state of chaos and disrepair. But more than that, because the walls were broken down, they were defenseless. There was no possibility of any improvement in their prosperity until such a time as they could protect their assets from the brigands that roamed the desert in those days. And yet it seems that no one before Nehemiah's arrival had the strength of purpose to attempt to change the situation. That is often so. There is an inertia about people. They go on the same old way. Haven't you seen churches which you can see are dying? But nobody does anything about it. They just keep on churning the old handle, fulfilling the old routine, because they lack leadership. They lack the motivator who is going to move them to do something about the situation, to change it. Nehemiah was that key factor for these people. The workers were there. It was just nobody to put the dynamite underneath them. So he arrived. And notice what he appeals to. What he uses in order to get them motivated. First of all, his personal enthusiasm. Come, let's rebuild the wall of Jerusalem and we'll no longer be in disgrace. He appeals to their sense of solidarity as the people of God. We don't want things to be like this, do we? Well, come on then, he says. He has personal enthusiasm and it's infectious. But notice he has something else to appeal to also, verse 18. I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king has said to me. See, if we're honest, there are all kinds of fanatics who stand up in church meetings or the like and say, the Lord has told me to do this or do that. And those of us who've been in the church for a few years know to be a little skeptical of that kind of statement. We want more evidence than just enthusiasm. But Nehemiah had it, you see. He had letters from the king. He had a testimony to how God had answered his prayer. a testimony to guidance, if you like, to calling. If we want to motivate people as spiritual leaders, enthusiasm isn't enough. We have to be able to show them in concrete terms that we do have a calling to do this from God, and that his hand of providence on our lives confirms it, not just our own mystical feelings. Put those two things together, though, enthusiasm and a clear call from God, and it's almost irresistible. Verse 18 again. They replied, let's start rebuilding. So they began this good work. Reconnaissance, then, examine the task. Motivation, stirring up the people. Those are two things that are absolutely vital to getting the ball rolling. There is something else there which is perhaps not quite so pleasant to talk about. Excluding the enemy. Look at verses 19 and 20 of that chapter. When Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard about it, they mocked and ridiculed us. What is this you're doing, they asked. Are you rebelling against the king? I answered them by saying, the God of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. But as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it. See, when you begin any work for God, you do have to make a policy decision about who you're prepared to work with. Because it's not uncommon today for churches to cooperate with practically anybody. If Mr. So-and-so with a big bank balance is willing to help, let him join us. Don't worry too much about his notorious affairs with his secretary. If the Reverend So-and-so, who happens to have a very large church building, is willing to help, well, let him join us too. Don't worry too much about his liberal theology. If Mrs. So-and-so, who plays the organ so nicely, is willing to help, let her join us. Don't worry too much about whether she really is a Christian or not. Because we don't like excluding people. Seems judgmental, illiberal, foreign to our 20th century environment. But Nehemiah suffered no such inhibitions, did he? As for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it. Quite clearly, Sanballat and Geshem and Tobiah and the others wanted a share of the action. They'd have been all behind Nehemiah if he'd taken them into alliance with him. And humanly speaking, it would have been a very sensible political move, wouldn't it? But they were very powerful men. But there are some people that God's leader cannot work with on principle. Namely, those who don't really belong to the people of God. No matter how powerful they may be, no matter how potentially useful their support would be, he really is better off without. So that's the third thing about getting the ball rolling, if you really want it to roll the right way, that is. Not just a question of evaluating the task and motivating the workers. You have to draw limits, too, on who's going to be involved. But there's just one fourth little thing I'd like to mention, too, under this heading. Appreciation for work done. Just look at chapter 3. Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. Now, that in itself is significant. You know, a high priest was a pretty influential chap, and here they are getting their hands dirty. They dedicated and set its doors in place, building as far as the Tower of the Hundred, and so on. We can't read all this chapter 3, but if you look down it, you will find that it's just a list of honours in which the contributions of each individual or clan is carefully noted and due credit given. Or in the case of verse 5, the nobles of Tekoa, who would not put their shoulders to the work under their supervisors, due criticism expressed. Appreciation, you see, is vital to the continuance of any work that people should feel their efforts are valued. Now, we're not always very good at that here. In fact, I don't think British people are terribly good at it generally. So easy to take people for granted, isn't it? And then be surprised when suddenly they lay down their trowel and say, I'm not doing any more. Oh, no, we shouldn't work for the sake of praise. But it is much easier to work when you feel appreciated, isn't it? And a wise leader, who wants not only to get the ball rolling, but to keep it rolling, knows when to show appreciation. Well, here it is then. Getting the ball rolling. Thoughtful planning, motivating the people, excluding the enemy, appreciating the workers. We've got some project in mind. We could learn an awful lot about management skills from Nehemiah. That's the first difficulty then. Getting the job off the ground. He succeeded in that very well, didn't he? But then, of course, once he's off the ground, discouragement starts rearing its head. Turn over to chapter 4, and you'll see what I mean. All kinds of pressure simply to give up. It starts with the scorn of Sanballat and his friends. When they heard we were rebuilding the wall, that the work had got underway, in other words, he became angry and was greatly incensed, and he ridiculed the Jews. What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore the wall? Why, says Tobiah, if a fox climbs up on it, he'll break down their wall of stone. It's pretty clear, I think you'll see, that these words were spoken at some kind of public occasion, a military display, perhaps, because we're told the Samaritan army was there, as well as its nobility. So the purpose of the remark was quite clearly to undermine the confidence of the Jews. Old Sanballat knew this would all get written up in the newspapers, it would be all over the headlines, and the Jews would hear about it. He wanted to undermine confidence in Nehemiah's leadership. And here's a classic way of doing it. Scorning what's going on. For of course, there is a vital stage early on in any project, but after the initial novelty has worn off, when people are very vulnerable to discouragement. You see that great pile of mess and you wonder whether you'll ever be able to do anything with it. It's easy then to give up. The last thing you need at that psychological moment is a wet blanket to confirm you in your dejection and pessimism about the situation. And that's just what Sanballat and Tobiah were doing, you see. It's a powerful weapon, mockery, when it's wielded at the right moment. But when that didn't work, in verses 6 to 8, we find they turned to threats. We rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height. And when Sanballat, Tobiah, and all the others heard that, they were very angry. Their anger reached new heights. And they plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble against it. It's clear from that list of allies that Sanballat had that Jerusalem was completely surrounded on all sides by hostile forces who were quite willing to shelve their mutual differences in a joint conspiracy against her. No doubt the fact that the emperor had personally endorsed Nehemiah's project made an all-out war unlikely. But there was plenty of opportunity for anonymous guerrilla raids and the like. And with such formidably armed foes all round them, and the walls still only half complete, the people must have been feeling very insecure, mustn't they? And then on top of the scorn and the threats comes the propaganda. Verse 11. Also our enemies said, before they know it or see us, we'll be right there among them and we'll kill them and put an end to the work. Now this is clearly a rumour that was spread about to increase the demoralisation and anxiety among Nehemiah's workers. It's hard to be an effective bricklayer, you know, when you're looking over your shoulder all the time, waiting for someone to hit you over the head. With all these discouragements then, the scorn, the threats, the propaganda that was flying around, it's no surprise that some of the people were beginning to cave in. Some of them made the excuse of exhaustion, verse 10. The strength of the labourers is giving out. There's so much rubble, we cannot rebuild the wall. See, the demoralisation was getting to work. The job's just too big, Nehemiah, we can't do it. And then worse still was the defeatism of verse 12. The Jews who lived near the enemies came and told us 10 times over, wherever you turn, they will attack us. In other words, those who were most accessible to enemy attack lived furthest out from the city centre. They were surrendering to this enemy propaganda and getting the jitters. They were getting panicky. Whatever we do, they're going to come and hit us. You must come away from the walls and stop working and defend us. 10 times over they come to him and say it. They were really neurotic, weren't they? With all these discouragements then, both outside and inside among the people, you could have excused Nehemiah if he himself had folded up, couldn't you? Then if any of you have been in my office and seen the little notice that someone has very kindly pinned to the wall up there, it goes, the objective of all dedicated working people should be to analyze thoroughly all situations, anticipate all problems prior to their occurrence, have answers for these problems, and move swiftly to solve those problems when called upon. However, it comments, when you are up to your neck in alligators, it is difficult to remind yourself that your initial objective was to drain the swamp. I think someone could have given that to Nehemiah at this particular point in his career, and he would have understood exactly what they meant. He was up to his neck in alligators, all kinds of discouragements, threatening to stop the work, to distract him from the initial objective. And yet I want you to notice how he copes with it. He copes with it really splendidly, doesn't he? First of all, by specific and public prayer. Look at verses 4 and 5. Hear us, O our God, for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their own heads. Give them over as plunder in a land of captivity. You might feel that prayer is pretty hard. But you see, this is a piece of public intercession offered to God in a situation when the community were under attack. He's asking God to defend his own honor, as the marginal version there, they provoked you to anger before the builders, makes quite clear. If we're convinced that we are engaged in God's service, then there are times when it is perfectly proper to pray against the enemy. I know we have to pray for our enemies, according to Jesus, but that isn't quite the same as praying for their success. It's perfectly proper sometimes to use prayer as a weapon against the plots of those who would seek to stop the rebuilding. And then again, he responds by practical vigilance. Verse 9, we prayed to our God, yes, and we posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. Like Cromwell, you remember, who told us to pray to God and keep our powder dry. There's absolutely nothing spiritual about being stupid. We must never think of prayer as a substitute for practical action. Nehemiah shows us that. Notice the third way he copes with these discouragements too. He counters it by personal exhortation. Look at verse 14. Don't be afraid, he says to the nobles, the officials, the rest of the people. Remember the Lord, who's great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, and your daughters, your wives, and your homes. He's a real pastor, exhorting his people, appealing to them to have confidence in God's power, and to be loyal to the fellowship. Fight for your homes, he says, for your families. Oh, I know the first motive, remembering the Lord, who is great and awesome, may be a nobler motive. But that doesn't mean the second is to be despised, because not everybody shares Nehemiah's faith. It's quite clear that some of his workers were getting the jitters. But he must put iron into their souls somehow. And the church isn't always as spiritually motivated as pastors would like, and a good pastor understands that. But supremely, of course, he counters the threat by intelligent strategy, doesn't he? Two particular pieces of strategic thinking we notice in the second half of chapter 4. First of all, he concentrates defense at the weakest points. Verse 13, I stationed some of the people behind the lowest points of the wall at the exposed places. Secondly, arming the workers. Verse 16, from that day on, half my men did the work, while the other half were equipped with spears and shields and bows and armor. Strategic thinking, you see, to counter the discouragement of these threats and this scorn and this propaganda that was being spread. Now, of course, the warfare we have to fight isn't military in nature, but the principle remains the same. Every member of the fellowship must see themselves as a spiritual warrior, not as a spectator. If the goal is to be achieved, if the church is to grow, then every one of us must be willing to do our bit in resisting the discouragements which the enemy throws in our path. We must all see ourselves as combatants. And we need people who are alert to spot the weak points and to blow the trumpet. Would that the church today were as alert to the weak points, were aware of those areas of doctrine and practice which are being threatened, which are vulnerable to attack. Would that there were somebody who could blow the trumpet and summon the people of God to that particular breach in the wall before it's too late. This is the way then to cope with discouragements. And you see, it does work. We're told that again and again, the work continued, the wall was rebuilt, the people worked on, they returned to the wall. The work continued, verse 21. Not easy, amidst many difficulties. But that's the way it has to be done, in spite of the difficulties. Okay then, so that's Nehemiah's coping with the discouragements that came his way, just as they will come our way too. Let's look thirdly at the way he copes with the difficulty of personal trials. Look at chapter 6. When word came to Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies, that I had rebuilt the wall and not a gap was left in it, though up to that time I had not set the doors in the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent me this message. Come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. Now you see the walls are just about finished, and the opportunity for direct assault, therefore, was greatly diminished. There was not much chance now of demoralizing the people. Their morale was beginning to rise. So the enemy moves to a different tack. Instead of trying to demoralize Nehemiah's workers, they try to demoralize Nehemiah himself. Notice the techniques they use. First, temptation. They attack his consecration to the task. Come, let's meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. Clearly this implied some kind of offer. No, we can come to some mutually acceptable arrangement, Nehemiah. After all, we governors must stick together, mustn't we? See how persistent they were in this enticement. In verse 4, we read that they sent the same message four times. And then not only was there this temptation to Nehemiah's consecration to the task, there was intimidation too, an attack on his reputation. Look at verses 5 to 7. Then the fifth time Sanballat sent his aid to me with the same message, and in his hand was an unsealed letter in which was written, it's reported among the nations, and Geshem says it's true, that you and the Jews are plotting to revolt, and therefore you are rebuilding the wall. Moreover, according to these reports, you're about to become their king, and have even appointed prophets to make this proclamation about you in Jerusalem. There is a king in Judah. Now this report will get back to the king. So come, let us confer together. Clever. Notice they sent it in an unsealed envelope. That's the 5th century BC equivalent of leaking the story to the press. It's not hard to imagine how many people had opened the envelope and read the contents before it got to Nehemiah, is it? It's a blatant attempt, you see, to destroy his public reputation, to insinuate the thought that he had revolution in mind. And of course it was an easy thought to sow when people are rebuilding defensive walls. Political blackmail, in other words. Nor were they satisfied with that. From temptation and intimidation, they moved to trickery. Look at verse 10. One day I went to the house of Shemaiah, son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was shut in at his home, and he said, come, let us meet in the house of God inside the temple, and let us close the temple doors, because men are coming to kill you. By night they're coming to kill you. Now, it's clear from verse 12, this chap was a prophet. And so, you see, there was an aura of credibility about him in Nehemiah's mind. He was supposed to be a spiritual chap, this, the sort of chap who got messages from God. And here he is saying, someone's coming to kill you. It's clever, that, isn't it? But, you see, he was a false prophet. hired by the enemy to seduce Nehemiah, either into an act of profanity, entering the temple when he shouldn't have done, or perhaps simply to an act of cowardice. Either way, it could be used against him to discredit him. I've got a word from the Lord here, Nehemiah. Your life's in danger. The sanctuary's the only place you'll be able to hide from them. Must have been very appealing to run, wasn't it? And then on top of all these things, the temptation and the intimidation and this trickery, there was pressure. The pressure of influential people in his own camp. Look at verses 17 to 19. This is very revealing. Also in those days, the nobles of Judah were sending many letters to Tobiah, and replies from Tobiah kept coming to them, for many in Judah were under oath to Tobiah, since he was son-in-law to Shechaniah, son of Ara, and his son Jehohanan had married the daughter of Meshullam, son of Bechariah. Moreover, they kept reporting to me his good deeds, and then telling him what I said. Well, you get the picture, don't you? The enemy had family contacts in the nobility of Judah, in the high ups. No wonder those nobles in Tekoa weren't too keen about putting their hands to the wall. They were probably Tobiah's relatives. So this fourth subtle pressure upon Nehemiah from influential people. That Tobiah's a good chap, you know. He's my brother-in-law. Good chap. You mustn't say anything against him, Nehemiah, will you? A fifth column. Practicing espionage to boot. For whatever Nehemiah said, got passed on to Tobiah. You can be sure about that. All these, then, assaults upon the life of the leader. Temptation, intimidation, trickery, pressure. And it is the same today. Just the same today. The flattering enticements. Oh, Roy, you will come and speak at our conference, won't you? Come to a meeting on the plain of Ono with us. Did you read that letter in the Evangelical Times about you, Roy? It's reported among the nations, and Geshem says it's true, that you're plotting to revolt. I really feel led, Roy, to tell you that you should be doing things this way. Shemaiah, son of Deliah, said, "Let us meet in the house of God inside the temple and close the temple doors." You do realize, don't you, Roy, that so-and-so is a relation of so-and-so, and they're very influential there, so you won't say anything about him to her, will you? The daughter of Meshullam had married the son, Jehohanan. It's the same. Never changes. But notice how Nehemiah reacted to it. First of all, he had the advantage of clear insight into the enemy's motives. Verse 2. They were scheming to harm me. See, he's not deluded about these chaps. Whatever positive recommendations may be coming from his nobility, he knows this Sanballat and Tobiah. He knows what sort of characters they are. The trouble with many Christians is, you see, we are gullible. We think people are nice, and they aren't. Clear insight into the enemy's motives. They were scheming to harm me. He knew it. Secondly, there was a clear refusal to be distracted from his task. Verse 3. "I am carrying on a great project," he replies, "and cannot come down to meet you. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you?" Right? He would not be distracted. Remember that Christian in Pilgrim's Progress would have never got into any trouble at all if he'd only stuck to the path he knew was right. Thirdly, a clear conscience before God and men. Verse 8. "I sent him this reply.
Nothing like what you are saying is happening. You are just making it up out of your head. See, that's the way to diffuse slander. It's impossible to blackmail a man of integrity. Fourthly, private prayer. Look at verse 9. They were all trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. But I prayed, "Thou strengthen my hands." It's one of the things you will notice as you read Nehemiah, that again and again, a prayer is interjected into the text. As if as Nehemiah writes his autobiography, he's reliving the experience. And prayer just rises from him as he writes. He remembers what he was praying, what his quiet times were like at that moment. And he interjects a little sample of the prayer that was on his heart. Notice that singular too. Strengthen my hands. You would understand the courage of this man, Nehemiah, a great deal better if we saw how often he was on his knees during this time. And finally, there was spiritual discernment. Verse 11. Should a man like me run away? Should one like me go into the temple to save his life? I will not go. For I realized that God had not sent him. He'd prophesied against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. He'd been hired to intimidate me so that I would commit sin by doing this and then they would give me a bad name to discredit me. The discernment. Nehemiah knew how to distinguish a false prophet from a true. And there is no more vital skill for any leader. Yes, and just one final thing to notice about him. Right to the end, he refused to become complacent. Look at the beginning of chapter 7. After the wall had been rebuilt, and I had set the doors in place, the gatekeepers and the singers and the Levites were appointed, I put in charge of Jerusalem my brother Hanani, along with Hananiah, the commander of the citadel, because he was a man of integrity and feared God more than most men do. I said to them, "The gates of Jerusalem are not to be opened until the sun is hot, and while the gatekeepers are still on duty, have them shut the doors and bar them. Also appoint residents of Jerusalem as guards, some at their posts and some near their own houses." It's not quite clear, actually, from my reading of the text, whether verse 3 should read until the sun is hot or while the sun is hot. It may be that he's saying that siesta was a dangerous time and that the gates were to be locked and barred by the gatekeepers during that vulnerable period. But whatever way you read it, he refused to relax his vigilance, even though the walls were complete, even though the doors were in place, even though the job had been done. It would have been so easy to relax, wouldn't it? You and I would have relaxed, wouldn't we? We'd have all sagged into a heap in our armchairs and sighed. But no, not Nehemiah. He never became complacent. He knew that battles could be won and campaigns yet be lost. The struggle to build the city of God is a continual one. Well, there you are then. Difficulties in getting the ball rolling to start with. Difficulties in facing discouragements as the work progresses. Difficulties of personal attacks on the leadership when the work is going really well. Those are the sort of things we must expect all the time in Christian service. You know, God has given us a work to do here at Eden. Some of you who've been here for quite a long while must sometimes look with amazement at just how things have changed in recent years. We've seen numerical increase, we've seen a new chapel, we've seen all kinds of opportunity opening up. A few years ago, we would have thought it impossible that we should come so far. But it's no longer impossible, it's happening. But that doesn't mean it's going to be easy. It is never easy. Like Nehemiah, we have a fight on our hands. We have balls to get rolling. Through spiritual management, we have discouragements to cope with. Through prayer and vigilance and intelligent strategy. Yes, and I do hope you pray for the leadership of the church. Because the more successful, humanly speaking, any church is, the more we must expect our leaders to be under attack. The more the devil will tempt them into compromise, intimidate them through misrepresentations, trick them through spiritual-sounding arguments, pressurize them through influential friends. I do hope you pray for the leaders. Pray for their spiritual insight, that they'll recognize danger before it strikes. Pray for their commitment to the task, that they won't allow themselves to be distracted. Pray for their integrity, that their consciences may be kept clear. Pray for their devotional life. They won't get squeezed out with all the busyness. Pray they won't surrender to complacency when the walls seem to be nearly finished. If we succeed in all that, we may find at the end of the day, like Nehemiah, that what once seemed impossible and has undoubtedly been difficult has, praise the Lord, finally been done. Let's pray together. Let's spend a few moments in quietness. Think of all we've learned through this man Nehemiah tonight. Maybe there have been one or two particular lessons that are of relevance to you. Well, commit them to your memory. Don't let yourself forget them.